The tech boom in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley is exploding. IPOs are turning hundreds of people into millionaires overnight. There are more than $50 billion companies in Silicon Valley. But the explosion comes with a price. We're seeing massive inequality, gentrified cities, rents are pushing people out of the Bay Area, and urban landscapes are drastically changing. So what makes this tech boom different from the one we saw in the late 90s? There's definitely a lot more money exchanging hands. How would you describe the differences, and how long will this current tech boom last? Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The tech industry is booming in ways we have not seen before. It is now common for companies to be worth billions of dollars. For example, privately owned Airbnb is valued at more than $20 billion, Uber, $40 billion, and Facebook, which went public 2 years ago, is now worth $275 billion. The question here is, what does the word worth actually mean? Well, just 15 years ago, the dot-com boom came to a crashing halt. Companies folded, tens of thousands of people lost their jobs, and then 8 years later, the global economy faced a full-fledged economic depression. Today, we are in the middle of another tech boom, with tech typhoons and their multi-billion dollar companies changing the social and economic landscape from the Bay Area to the peninsula. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, the median rent in San Francisco climbed to over $4,200 this month, the latest milestone in a housing boom that saw rental costs in the city rise 13% last year. So how long will this current tech boom last? Will the latest tech boom lead to another bust? And if it doesn't, what does that mean? To discuss the proliferation of the tech sector and its impact on our city and communities, we are joined by two guests. David Talbot is a journalist and former editor-in-chief of Salon.com. He also founded Salon during the last tech boom. David is author of Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love, a seminal history of San Francisco during the turbulent activist years of the 60s and the 70s. He is also founder of the New Vision SF. This is a think tank to present alternative ideas in San Francisco, and it is launching today. And David joins me in studio. Hi, David. Great to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Rose.
Thanks for coming in. We're also joined by Jason Ben-Levy. He's a longtime technology marketing communications professional in Silicon Valley and author of the book Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. And Jason is also in studio. Hi, Jason. Thank you for coming in.
Great to be here live and in person.
Yeah, we always chat online, so it's great to see you. So all three of us were involved in the tech boom of the 90s in different ways. And you all follow this very, very closely and write about it. Jason, what really strikes you about the current tech boom?
Okay. Well, we're in a bubble for sure, but it's a very different bubble than we were in last time. What we're in right now, last time we had what would probably be called a public bubble. This time we're in what's called a private bubble. That last time the idea of a company was to go and rush to public market and have an IPO so people could cash in their shares and become instant millionaires. But as we saw after 2000, a lot of stock people buying stocks, regular consumers buying stocks, went, well, this really doesn't work for me. So we still have a bunch of founders out there who want to go and start companies, and we have an enormous amount of wealthy people around the world. It's not just U.S. investors anymore. Mm. So there's a lot of slush money in the world, and so a lot of companies are being startups, and they're being funded, but they're being funded by private funds. So they're delaying going to an IPO stage because they will be subject to the scrutiny of what their valuation would be. So normally we look at a company and we say, what's the market cap on that company? So we can look at Apple and we can multiply the amount of shares times the value times the price that day of the shares, and then we know what the market cap is. On the way it's working with private capital-based companies is that whoever the last investor is, so if you go and spend whatever amount it is for that last part, if you say it's 10% of the company that you're buying, it's whatever that last price was multiplied times the rest of the company. So if you're buying 1% of, or if you're buying 10% of the company, we'll just make up a number here. If you're buying 1% of the 10% of the company for $5 billion, that means that the rest of the company is worth a multiple of that. So that would be like $100 million. So companies that we're seeing right now that have these valuations don't really have the valuation. So Uber, as an example, it's based on a loan that they received, not even selling shares. They basically borrowed several billion dollars, I can't remember the exact number, but they borrowed money, and that money converts into being stock should it ever go public.
Okay, because last year, in the middle of the year, this time, Uber was valued at about $18 billion.
Right.
Today, it's valued at about $41
billion. Right. And there's no difference. What happened is that someone bought a portion of the company, and so you revalue the rest of the company based on the portion that was sold. So you take all the rest of the shares and use the same apply that same number across it. And so
why is this important to understand?
Because there's really not as much value there as it looks, and that there's a lot of synthetic money being created.
Because the Chronicle had a piece the other day about this home out at 10th and California. It was a three-bedroom, nice home.
Right.
Listed for about $1.5 million, and it went for $3 million.
Right.
And there's so many people paying cash.
Right.
And the article said that there's so much funny money floating
exactly.
around, but the funny money has real-life consequences.
It does when it can be converted. So sometimes it gets converted. In the case of when Twitter went public, a company that makes no money and has been in business for 8 years and has not made a profit yet, but all the principals wound up walking away with hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right.
In addition to people who signed on early and had some percentage of the stock. It also goes the other way. Companies like Zynga went public and immediately went up and then crashed out, taking down a lot of people along with it who never saw a dime.
So explain to us just quickly. I'm glad you're bringing all this up because I've been asking these questions. When Twitter went public, it makes no money, you say, right?
It makes no profit.
Zero.
Right. It's been 8 years old and hasn't made a profit yet.
When Twitter went public, it created 1,600 millionaires overnight.
Right. Because that's when it converts from the shares that are owned by founders and owned by venture capital companies and owned by other investors into the general public market. That's what the initial public offering. So that gets converted to stock, and then real money from consumers and from investment funds and from retirement funds goes into that space, and the money gets converted into being real currency as opposed to potential money.
Now, Jason sounds very certain when he says this bubble is definitely, we were definitely in a bubble. Now, the question is, will it burst? But what are your thoughts, David? Are we in a bubble?
Well, you know, I went through the first dot-com bubble in a smaller way with Salon, which was a pioneering magazine, online magazine that I founded back in 1995. And so we rode that crazy roller coaster back then and, you know, had many near-death experiences. But I'm proud to say Salon is still here. And there are some stable companies that came out of that that actually produced some value. But I think the impact on the city of this latest boom actually is much more negative. Even in the last time. I mean, the last time we had a share of obnoxiousness and greed and all that and froth. But this one has had a much more significant impact in terms of the impact on housing and the wealth gap, the inequalities in this city. There's severe dislocations. And so what we had was basically a city hall under Ed Lee, our mayor, who got completely enchanted, enamored of the new tech moguls and the shiny new tech toys. And he gave away the city to these people and gave away tax incentives to them that encouraged all these companies like Twitter and others to set up their headquarters here. But he didn't do all the necessary planning for that dislocation. So suddenly the city is awash with engineers who are making a lot of money and they're looking for housing. And of course, the landlords are going to start squeezing longer term residents out of their housing in order to make more money. And so that's what's happened now. We have, skyrocketing evictions, San Francisco has become ground zero for the wealth gap. We have the biggest, quickest exploding wealth gap in the country. We have it's the now less affordable than New York to live here, in amazingly, than cities like New York. So we need to have more planning, and that's what got thrown out the window. There's no one like in the old days who seems to have a long-range vision for the city, and that's why a number of people, including myself, and I'm not just the founder, by the way, there's many others involved in this, Vision San Francisco, including the great, very civic-minded former city attorney Louise Rennie, Tim Redmond, who's a great investigative journalist, late of The Big Guardian and now 48 Hills, his wonderful blog that everyone should read, John Gollinger, who was involved with Art Agnos, another great hero in the waterfront debate, and, you know, actually injected democracy through Prop B, into the whole waterfront and the whole issue of planning in the city. The people get to vote on now high-rise buildings before they're developed. So we need to have the public much more involved. We need to have more ideas. We need to have a wider debate about this. And unfortunately, we're in a situation now where Ed Lee is running unopposed for mayor this fall. We don't know who's actually running City Hall. In fact, it's a very small clique of people, you know, big tech investors, wealthy people like Ron Conway, who's behind Airbnb. And so these companies are getting a free ride, Uber, Airbnb, the companies that Jason's been talking about. And they're not working on the same playing field with other businesses in this town. And so San Francisco is severely out of whack right now.
Right.
The Twitter tax break got a lot of attention just in terms of policies. And many different studies found that the city could forego, because of the Twitter tax break, about $22 million a year, an additional $34 million after the company went public. Can you talk a little bit more about policies? When you say that the mayor has sold out to these companies, a couple weeks ago, the U.S. Conference of Mayors was in town, and Ed Lee presented attendees with an app built by Salesforce. He took mayors on tours of Uber and Twitter. A bunch of cab drivers protested outside of Uber's offices when he did that. And then a lot of techies like Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer, Twitter co-founder Biz Stone, Salesforce CEO Mark Benioff are all frequent contributors to Mayor Ed Lee.
That's right. Well, these companies, as I say, aren't forced to play in the same level playing field with other businesses. They have unfair advantages. They don't take care of their employees. They're not unionized. I've talked to Uber drivers who complain bitterly about how shabbily they're treated by this multi-billion-dollar company. None of that wealth is filtering down to the worker level. In fact, they don't even call them workers. They refuse to call them workers.
Right.
The people who are employed by these firms aren't called workers. They're contractors or some silly term like that.
We're doing a show on that tomorrow.
Oh, good. Good, good. Yeah, so, I mean, Airbnb, Uber, they are closely aligned with the money men behind Ed Lee, and they're given these unfair advantages through tax incentives. They're not compelled, as I said, to play in the same level playing field, and yet they're disrupting major industries in this town, like the hotel industry that is unionized, that does pay its fair share of taxes, and Airbnb is devouring that business.
Right. Well, we have a problem here with that. You know, a lot of cities are having trouble with Airbnb and Uber, but we happen to have it headquartered here. So we have this double problem that that their political influence is almost counter to the culture of San Francisco, which is to be progressive and friendly toward workers and toward neighborhoods. And I don't know about you, but my neighborhood's being invaded by Airbnbs constantly. Mm-hmm. And so we're becoming less of a neighborhood, and people looking for a place to rent, the places are being taken up by Airbnb.
San Francisco is becoming so expensive, people are being forced actually to rent their places to Airbnb whenever they leave for the weekend or go away on vacation.
And some friends who live near the peninsula said, when you do the show, can you please talk about the fact that we don't have rent control laws? And so a lot of people who live along the peninsula, San Mateo, for example, their rents are going up drastically,
right,
and they have no choice but to try to move to the East Bay if they can or leave the Bay Area altogether. So we're getting a lot of attention here because of rent control laws and the Ellis Act evictions, but people up and down the peninsula are not really getting the attention they deserve because they don't have rent control. And
well, so frankly, even in San Francisco, there are major loopholes in our rent control laws. They only control housing that was built before 1979.
Right.
They don't control condos or single-family homes.
Yeah.
So many people, there was a Chronicle piece about a woman who worked for the city, mm-hmm, and is the kind of bedrock that we need here. She's a young mother. Her husband is a firefighter. She works for City Hall, and yet she can't afford to live in the city. city where she's working.
Right.
This is happening all over the city now at this point. It's a crisis, and we need to address it. We need to get involved. And if we aren't going to have a mayor's race when these things should be debated this fall, then we as citizens have to do it ourselves through organizations like Vision SF, which I'm starting with, as I say, this group of wonderful civic-minded people. And I can give you more information about that later.
Yeah, definitely. But Jason, some people might say, wait, there's no one running against the mayor of San Francisco. How is that possible?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I think that part of the problem is ranked choice voting, which, at least in my district, allowed someone to win her seat initially with 22% of the vote. So I think that, you know, sometimes technology gets in the way of democracy, too, which, as you know, is one of my issues, that we think that we've got digital democracy, but we actually fool ourselves on it. Ed Lee is someone, if he faced a runoff in the last election, may not have come out as sweet as he did in the final toll.
Well, his numbers were below 50% not long ago, and he's running unopposed.
Right.
It reminds me of the senator,
the
version. Well, the Soviet version, or the senator, I think it was John Ashcroft in Missouri, who was running for re-election against a dead man.
Oh, that's right.
And yet he was losing in the polls.
Right. Yes,
so
Carnahan.
That's how supposedly popular our mayor is, our incumbent mayor.
Right.
David Talbot is a journalist and former editor-in-chief of Salon.com, author of Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. He's one of many founders of Vision SF. This is a new think tank to present alternative ideas in San Francisco. We're also joined by Jason Ben-Levy, longtime technology marketing communications professional in Silicon Valley and author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. Today, we are talking about the current tech boom. It is exploding in ways we have not seen before. Just 15 years ago, the dot-com boom came to a crashing halt. And then in 2008, we got the global financial crisis. So what are your thoughts on what we are facing today? What do you think are the major differences between today's tech boom and the tech boom in the late 90s? Do you think that we're in a bubble? Do you think it'll burst? If you work in the industry, we'd love to hear from you. And how are you seeing this tech boom affecting your community? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. We want to hear about the good, the bad, and the ugly. What are you seeing today? Have you been directly affected by it? Are you benefiting from it? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Michelle in Salinas. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the show.
Hi, yes. One of the things that I've noticed when it comes to this situation is that the community hasn't, the community at large, I should say, hasn't been educated on the fact that they can ask for things. You know, these companies are bypassing the residents and going straight to the mayors and councilmen and buying them off. But the community still has a voice, and unfortunately, they haven't been educated to exercise that voice to say, hey, you know, Uber, if you're going to come into the community, we need help with our housing infrastructure. We need help with our schools needing books or, you know, things like that. They can ask for stuff, and they don't know. And so you have these people that are actually working for these companies and basically can't even afford to live with it, can no longer afford to live within the community, you know, that the companies in that they're working for. So, I mean, that's part of the problem is that if people knew that they can say, you know, either you're going to give us this, you're going to pay to play to be in our community, you know, or you're not going to be here. If people knew that, then, you know, the bad deals with the mayor and the council people and all that, you know, it couldn't happen. But it's just, you know, people haven't been educated on that. Politics is not, you know, a required subject in high school. It's like maybe like a 2 month or, you know, a semester thing that they go over quickly in history class,
right,
and that's it.
Well, thank you for that.
Sure.
Jason.
You know, what's really interesting is there's a piece this week in Business Week about Uber and what it's spending on lobbying. Mm-hmm. And right now, Uber is employing 290 lobbyists, 29 PR agencies. It is a larger lobbying operation than Walmart. And what they are managing to do is to go to cities and override the laws that existed before that helped protect people having safe rides and protecting the local business, which is the cab business. And I find it really kind of ironic when I hear people championing Uber and saying that we're being disruptive. And it's kind of funny to have a bunch of rich white guys going into communities and disrupting people who are working class people who are driving a cab.
I think that's heroic.
Yeah. And, well,
and again, we are going to talk about that tomorrow, but you also have a lot of former Obama administrations.
That's right. David Flof is heading up this entire effort
at Uber.
For Uber.
And he ran President Obama's 2008 campaign.
Exactly.
So you have a lot of Obama administration officials going to work in the tech industry.
Well, and that's the problem. So, you know, money and clout tend to win when it comes to democracy, unless the people get angry enough to fight back. And there are tipping points. We all know this in American history, when people finally were fed up enough to do something. I'm hoping in San Francisco, the progressive capital of America, that people will finally get to that tipping point soon. But, you know, we need to organize, and we do need to fight back. Ed Lee, you know, is maybe not a lost cause. Ed Lee, as I write about in my book, Season the Witch, was once a community activist. He was a local hero. He fought against developers and greedy landlords in Chinatown. He fought at the I Hotel where right. Jason, as a young man, protested to protect those people, low-income people who are living in that SRO hotel. And so, you know, maybe we need to appeal to Ed's conscience in his next term. If he's not going to run, on his record and debate, he has to then, I think, maybe get in touch with the younger Ed Lee. And we can only hope for that.
Well, and to Michelle's call, do you feel like things have changed in terms of community members sitting at the table with the tech industry to talk to each other? Because I moderated an event in the Mission, oh, say 6 months ago, about gentrification and people being kicked out, and people were really angry for reasons we can all understand. But a lot of people said they feel like there's just no effort to talk to each other. Has that changed at all?
You know, I think there's this feeling that the new wave of people is here and the old people should just get out of the way. And I find that over and over again when I'm on blogs and people say, well, market forces are what they are and rents are more
inevitable.
And change is inevitable. And just like, you know, people like, you know, your generation kicked people out of San Francisco, you know, we're moving on. But in reality, if you remember San Francisco in the 60s and 70s, it was a city that was emptying out. People were moving to the suburbs. And so people moved to the Castro and moved to the Haight because it was an inexpensive place to live. No one wanted to live there. So we had a flourishing bohemian community in these places because people were leaving.
But in a way, you know, I think we have the makings of a powerful coalition to fight back and really get San Francisco centered again. Think of old San Francisco, the people who care about cultural heritage and historic preservation. Think about, working families who are being displaced. Think about the activists who I celebrate and the dreamers and the artists in Season of the Witch. You know, and look, a lot of the young engineering types who are working for these tech companies, they could be displaced soon if they lose their job when the bubble bursts and all that. So they have to remember that their, you know, prosperity may be short-lived. I think we could build a very powerful coalition to take this city back. I think even the people who've come here in this new wave came here for a reason, because San Francisco is cool. Why is it cool? Because we fought, and many people died in the 60s and 70s, even on the streets. People were assassinated in the city. There were bloody riots to make San Francisco this enlightened beacon to the world that it is today. So people came here for a reason, and I think many, many people want to preserve what's best about San Francisco, even as it's changing.
Right. And actually, that's really interesting, because there is a class difference between people who are founders of these companies and people who work at the companies.
That's right.
And they're struggling to find a place to live and get a job and get through also. Many of them have just come straight from college and are managing to work, and so they've never really encountered that much hardship, even though they may be carrying a huge load of student loans. But I think that the fact that they're moving to the Mission and places like that, it says something about them, that there's some sort of, you know, needing to have something genuine as opposed to being in the bubble all the time.
I agree. Even though they're displacing Latino families and working families there, there's a reason that attracted them to the Mission,
right, exactly.
Because it is more livable. When you look at some of the new housing that's going up in the city, it's ugly. It looks like Legos to me. I call it Lego buildings, or Lego after Ed Lee. And, you know, it looks like it's built by robots for robots. It looks like it's built for people who work and live in cubicles. cubicles all day long. No one wants to live in that kind of building. You know, we just on aesthetic basis alone, we need to fight to save San Francisco.
Right.
And you can see it when you drive across the Bay Bridge.
Oh, God,
it's
yes.
just the cranes. It's amazing to see how many are out there. And then up and down Market Street in the Mission, as you can't even keep up with
right.
it.
Right. Oh, and the building near the Mint, if you've seen that one, oh, my God. It looks like Los Angeles 1962.
Well, today we are talking about the tech boom. I know we're talking about San Francisco a lot, but that is because a lot of people in Silicon Valley, and I remember meeting them about 4 or 5 years ago, they said, we're bored down here. We want to move to San Francisco. And they put pressure on the companies to either open an office in San Francisco or bus them back and forth. And now we're seeing the results of that. We're talking about the tech boom, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, a program that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. Toll free, 866-798-8255. Or you can send your question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org or simply leave your comment on the website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Then at noon today, Philosophy Talk with John Perry and Ken Taylor. Following that at 1, Big Picture Science from our friends at the SETI Institute in Mountain View.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about whether the Uber economy is good or bad for workers. The California Labor Commission recently ruled that one of Uber's drivers qualifies as an employee rather than an independent contractor. Uber drivers are treated as contractors. So how should the laws surrounding these services, not only Uber, but TaskRabbit, so many of these companies that rely on what they call independent contractors, so they might not have a regular schedule, they don't get any benefits. What do we need to know about these workers? How should they be treated? And what about the companies that rely on these workers? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about something related, the tech industry. It's booming in ways we have not seen before. It's now common for companies to be worth billions of dollars. When a company goes public, it's very common for the company to create hundreds of millionaires overnight. And as a result, we're seeing massive inequality, rents skyrocketing in ways that we have not seen before. What are your thoughts about this current tech boom? How is it affecting your community? Will it last? Will it lead to another bust? Give us a call at 866-798-8255. If you work in tech, we'd also love to hear from you. We're joined by David Talbot, a journalist and former editor-in-chief of Salon.com. He's author of Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance in the City of Love. He is one of many founders of Vision SF. This is a new think tank that was designed and created to present present alternative ideas in San Francisco. Jason Benlevy is a longtime tech marketing communications professional in Silicon Valley and author of the book Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. And we've got full lines, so let's go next to Alexandra in Sunnyvale. Hi, Alexandra. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I am commenting on Sunnyvale. I live in Sunnyvale, which is on the edge of the South Bay of the San Francisco area. And I'm talking about how rents are almost impossible to afford for students in the area because there's so many Google and Apple employees in the area that make such incredible paychecks compared to the average student working at Jamba Juice or whatever. And I've seen a lot of people around my age living in incredibly tight conditions, you know, like 10 people living in an apartment just to afford to go to community college.
Wow. What are the current rents, Alexandra? What are you seeing right now in Sunnyvale?
I'm seeing for a one-bedroom, $2,000.
Wow.
Mm. Yeah, and it's just incredibly hard to live.
And how are you doing it?
With student loans, with help from parents, with skimping on everything, with food stamps, I mean, every chip in the book just to try to live out here.
And can I ask you, Alexander, you sound young. Do you go to community college?
Yeah, I go to De Anza College.
Okay, and so what are you hearing from students at De Anza about this tech boom?
Well, I have a good friend who worked for Google for a long time, and she worked in the cafeteria at Google, and she was seeing, you know, a lot of young people around our age who were working in the tech field, and how much more money they were making than her, and how they got more access to the benefits, like, for example, the buses that Google provided to take people from the bus stops and from the train stops to Google, because she was a cafeteria worker and technically employed by a separate agency, even though technically it was totally Google.
Right.
She was not given access to the same sort of benefits.
Yeah.
That's a very important point. I think sense that more and more people, not just students like Alexandra, but many people have now, that we're living in two different societies, one for the elite and one for the rest of us. And so we have now these luxury buses that take workers to and from Apple and Google, while the rest of us are in overcrowded, increasingly less dependable public transportation. And, you know, that just can't happen in a democracy. At some point, there's going to be an explosion point.
And the other argument against that is that the people who take these buses might not vote for increased money for public transportation or fight for better public transportation.
Or even just share the common experience of like knowing who your neighbors are.
Right.
I mean, in New York, it's common on the subway to see both rich and poor people. And here it's becoming so stratified that that's not happening.
And
Uber's contributing to that, too, by the way.
And since she brought up her friend at Google, a lot of these companies do contract out, and they were getting a lot of bad press about it. And so Facebook, just a couple of months ago, last month, announced that any contractor that works with Facebook has to pay their workers $15 an hour and then also give 15 days off a year.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, because many of these drivers were being pushed beyond their limits, and it was actually unsafe, I think, for even the people they were driving. They're working too long hours. They weren't protected. They didn't have benefits. And so I think finally now there's union drives within the Teamsters and other unions starting to organize those bus drivers, and that's long overdue.
Right, because a lot of them had split shifts, so they would show up to bring people in the morning commute, didn't really own their time in between, and then had to do the return commute.
Do you think other companies will follow suit?
I think several have signed union contracts, haven't they?
I think, there's a tipping point. As some begin to, others will be forced to follow.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in with those stories, Alexandra. Let's go next to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I am a fourth-generation San Franciscan, and so I've seen a lot of changes, and I have records from my family about changes in the city. But one of the things I have a question about, we're talking about essentially we've recreated a feudal society. And why aren't we talking about the morality of this? Or how do we talk about the morality of this situation where we've got some people making an awful lot of money and other people in the service industry serving those people? And the economic gap has a moral quality to it as well as the social responsibility of building giant buildings and monster houses and all these things. How do we talk about the morality of that?
Well, part of that is that the conversation is kind of one-sided because we're dealing with people who live inside a bubble who are libertarian generally by their politics and believe that market forces should rule. And that as long as they can control the agenda themselves, they will. So how do we get on an even footing with that? And again, this is part of the Ed Lee situation is how do we have someone who actually represents us?
That's right. It has to be done politically. But I think now we're getting to the point where the wealth gap has become such an explosive issue around the world. And by the way, Pope Francis has made this a moral and ethical issue, as your caller points out. And so we do have far-sighted leaders like Pope Francis who are beginning to focus on this. And we need that kind of enlightened leadership at the local level as well. I mean, even the Democratic Party, which frankly has become sort of owned since Clinton by Wall Street, even Hillary Clinton now is forced to be running as a populist. So, that's the kind of shift that we need here in San Francisco as well.
What are your thoughts, though, on her main question? How do you turn this into more of a moral conversation?
There might be a way to shame them somehow. I'm not quite sure what it is. But certainly there's a rage circulating in it and how to harvest that?
Well, I think it's like climate change. Uh-huh. You know, it's now we're at the tipping point with climate change again, in part because of Pope Francis and his recent encyclical on this. But, you know, we're at a point, I think, where there are three major issues that the world is confronting, and they've become such critical issues. They're ones of survival. One is the planet, is climate change. One is the wealth gap. We're having this gaping disparity between people that live in completely different worlds. And finally is the issue of permanent war that America's involved in. You know, my entire life we've been at war with some country or another. And these things by the younger generation, you know, particularly by the younger generation, I think there's a growing sense that they don't want to live in that kind of world, where we're always at war, where there's grotesque disparities between the poor and the rich, and the planet is burning. I mean, who would want to grow up and who would want to raise children in that world? So I do think it's a moral issue. I think the Catholic Church is now confronting this, and that is, you know, to the great benefit of the world. And I think our religious leaders, our spiritual leaders, and our political leaders all need to adopt that same vision. It's one of survival.
Well, thank you for calling in, Mary. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Hello. Hi. I wanted to make a comment. I'm actually a cab driver who's been driving in the city for 27 years. And due to this Uber tech bubble, I have my income has dropped dramatically. And so now I no longer feel like it's an option to drive a cab, and so this business has kind of been decimated. So now I'm thinking about moving. I am fortunate because I actually purchased property back in the 90s. So I in the Mission. So I feel that I'm ready to actually. I actually built my home in the Mission myself, and now I'm ready to. I'm considering selling and actually moving because the flavor of the city is not what I'm aligned with, and it's a shame because I just feel like the disparity and the folks that are taking over the city have just brought a different flavor that doesn't really align with my lifestyle.
Well, John, as a cab driver, you see and you hear a lot more than most people. What strikes you as the differences between this tech boom and the last one?
Well, the last tech boom seemed to be like you mentioned, it was money that had come in and people were just buying up services. It kind of seems like people are actually buying equity here. There was service industry was booming, and not that it's not booming now, but they're actually, I feel like the money now is more purchasing actual pieces of the city, for example, real estate. So, you know, it doesn't seem much different. The other tech boom felt a little bit it just didn't seem the same.
Yeah, well, thank you for calling. The other thing, and we touched on this earlier, is that there's a lot more money exchanging hands now. And back in the 90s, you just knew that these businesses were going to go under. They
right.
just they didn't make money.
Right.
But now you've got Facebook made over $12 billion last year, 90% from ads. I was just looking up Apple profits. In January of this year, Apple posted the biggest quarterly profit in history.
Right.
They're making a ton of money.
Right.
So companies this time around are actually making money.
Well, actually, they were last time, too. So it's you have to distinguish between different kinds of companies. So Apple and even Fitbit is kind of an old line company. They actually go and make something and sell it and make a profit.
And so, Fitbit sells a bracelet that you wear, and so it can track the number of steps you take,
right.
how you're sleeping.
And they just went public about 2 weeks ago.
And this was a huge IPO.
It was a huge IPO, but they are a profitable company.
Because they're getting a monthly subscriber fee.
No, not necessarily. They have that too, but you don't have to do that.
Okay, but they sell something.
They sell something, which is like a really the old-fashioned way of doing business.
Right.
I mean, there's basically only a couple businesses you can do if you're involved in the net, which is something that's ad-supported, like doing media. You can be a merchant, which Amazon or any other number of small merchants. You can be an agency, and an agency means anything from Uber to being Airbnb to being Travelocity or whatever. So it's just like your money is just passing through you. And to some degree, some of the payment companies that are starting to show up now are agencies because they're letting money pass through them, something like Square. And the cloud storage companies, which are popping up and are a dime a dozen, all indistinguishable from each other. And the old-fashioned way to make money is to make something and sell it. Apple's in the old-fashioned school of making something and selling it. Someone like Twitter has absolutely no conceivable way to ever make enough ad revenue to make that company profitable.
But the companies that are making money...
Right.
Do you still think that they're not going to do well, or will they just lift the tech boom and make it continue?
Well, I think that it's stratified. So Facebook has figured out how to sell ads within its frame. It's not super profitable for what's usually called a price-to-earnings ratio, which is how you really judge a company. So they're not in great shape like Apple is. Apple's making a ton of money. They're not in the same game. So some of these companies are going to disappear because they really don't make anything and they're undistinguishable.
Bros, if I could go back to your last caller, though, and say what a shame it is that people like him who do have a stake in the city and have lived here a long time, built his own house, for God's sake, with his own hands in the Mission, feel that they're being squeezed out now. You know, and it's people of color as well. We just saw that damning report that was released by the city that even though African Americans only represent 6% of the population, they're being arrested at seven times the rate of white people, and they're being convicted at 10 times the rate of white people in the city. And as Jeff Adachi, the public defender, said, this is a shame on the city. It's a damning report for a city that's supposed to be the most progressive in America. But I don't want to just bum people out today. You know, you can fight back. And we have recent examples of where people have organized in the city and fought back and won. Art Agnos, John Gollinger, the activist, and others who worked on the campaign on the waterfront to push through, to stop that hideous development at One Washington, to get the Warriors to move their glass palace off the Embarcadero, where it should never have been, and to push through Prop B, which for the first time democratizes the planning process in the city that allows people to vote on buildings that are going to be over a certain height. Those were huge victories for the democracy in San Francisco. So let's not be so demoralized that we think it's the game is over. It's not. We have to get our act together. We have to fight back. My book, Seas and the Witch, what that was all about was that San Francisco that we know and love was built by people who fought and bled and put everything, blood, sweat, and tears into the city. And that's how you get a city that's worth living in.
What major changes would you both like to see? Because the fact is, most of us use these services, enjoy these services, and there's a reason why they're making so much money, right?
Well, some of them aren't. I mean, again, you know, some of the biggest companies in town don't make a profit. Salesforce, which has been here and have been a major influence and is going to building the tallest building in San Francisco.
West of the Mississippi.
That's right. Does not make a profit.
They don't make a profit?
They don't make a profit because of the way that the company is structured on their own sales force, how many incentives they pay out, they are not profitable. They haven't made a profit in years.
How many people are they bringing to San Francisco when that building is done?
Well, I'm not sure. I know that they've got the naming rights on the building. They gave up the campus where they were going to build it, where the Warrior Stadium is planned to go. And I'm not sure whether they did that because they could sell off the property at a nice profit.
But at least you have, in the case of Salesforce, a mogul, a CEO, Mark Benioff, who does feel some responsibility to the city and has given a lot in the form of charity back to the city. Of course, the Children's Hospital in Mission Bay and public education and many other things. All too often, these people who are profiting from the city, who are attracting workforces that want to live in a cool city like San Francisco, are just ripping off the city. And so that's what we need to reverse.
Right.
I mean, there used to be, I think, a great sort of generation of mainly Jewish, frankly, philanthropists and civic-minded people like Warren Hellman and the Haas family and others who gave enormously to the city. And that was a great contribution to San Francisco. The museums, Chrissy Field, the ballet and the opera, music in the park, these were all because of these civic-minded, wealthy people. We need those people to be involved. We need them to be involved with organizations now like Vision SF, to plug that again, because this is what San Francisco needs at this point. We are at a turning point, and it's vital that we all come together, rich and poor, people from all across the political spectrum, to fight for the city that we all love.
And so what does that mean exactly? What changes, tangible changes, would you like to see, David?
Well, here's what I think we need. We need, first of all, a general plan. We need a plan for the city as a whole, so we're not just sort of growing willy-nilly. Whatever shiny toy, you know, whatever new company comes in and demands some kind of giveaway from City Hall gets it. Right now, we don't have that kind of plan. You know, it's City Hall is up for sale, so we need to have people in City Hall, in public office, who have the public good at heart and have a vision for the city that's a long-range vision. And right now, elected officials tend to listen just to groups like SPUR that are very pro-growth, very pro-development. We need to hear from the entire electoral body in the city about what is needed in the way of housing, in the way of transportation, in the way of new jobs. And it shouldn't just be a giveaway to the tech sector. You know, housing and health represent two of the biggest, the hotel business and the health industry represent two of the biggest industries in this town. Why aren't we talking more about them? But it's always about Twitter. It's always about tech. We need to think about manufacturing businesses, about nonprofits, about creative enterprises that employ artists. These are the things that make a city great. You know, I was thinking about this the other day, all the artists, the dreamers, the crazies, the rebels who made San Francisco so cool, all the people I wrote about in San Francisco, they couldn't afford to live in San Francisco anymore. Do we want that kind of city that's so monochromatic, that's so one-dimensional, that's so techie, it's boring? I don't think anyone wants to live in that city, not even the techies.
We have an email from Chris who says, how many employees does it really take to run Twitter? Is it really 4,000 or more like 1,000? And what will happen when they start laying people off?
I don't Well, we've seen the layoffs with tech people before, and they wind up, struggling. Certainly, a lot of people with the same skills will be in the marketplace. I know that for older programmers in the Valley who are not in their 20s and 30s, that it's really a tough road to get a job. And we remember after the last tech boom that people who were working at tech companies were suddenly working in cafes a year later. So, which may be part of the natural evolution of learning empathy is learning to do something other than be in front of a screen.
It looks like they employ right now about 3,600 people.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for the email. Sort of a related call. Let's hear from Richard in Piedmont. Hi, Richard.
Yeah. I have to say that I'm a bit confused because when I tuned in, I thought the discussion was going to be about the viability of the bubble. And what has happened, and I think it's a product of the guests that you've had, are sort of gearing the discussion toward whether, you know, a socioeconomic discussion. And I think it would be more informative because it might be self-defining, because if the bubble doesn't work, then a lot of those people that are buying up all this stuff are going to be, out of luck. So I wanted to hear more of a discussion, and it started to get there, but then it got commandeered back to this socioeconomic discussion, which is a very judgmental discussion. And is this bubble viable? I don't agree with you that all the companies are making money. I think there are a lot that aren't. And that's where the discussion, I thought that's where the discussion was going to exist.
Right. Actually, I have been saying that they are not making money, and it is very inflated. And because a lot of this is private equity money out there, and at some point it does start running down, people will start wondering why they are not making money. That is that these companies don't really become fortunes until they do become public companies. So a private investor will put money in there in the hopes that a company goes public and they get their money back in some multiple. And right now, there's not a lot of companies going IPO.
And actually, I do think the other part of this discussion we've had this morning about the social costs of this boom actually do factor into the question that the gentleman brought up, because you can only go so long as a startup, as a new company, offloading those social costs to the city, to the people, to others other than your own your bottom line, before that begins to bite you back. So that is a relevant discussion.
And some prominent people in the tech industry say that we are in a bubble and it's going to burst. This cannot last. last. Right. Others say, no, this is what we're going to have for the near future. No,
they said that before, too. And,
but, so what does it mean if it bursts?
Well, if it bursts, it means that people will be losing jobs, that people lower on the ladder or higher paid. And no matter what it is, it's going to hit all the spectrum. There's no doubt about that. The people at the very top of the spectrum who are founders will still walk away with a lot of money. That's already a done deal. So it's very conceivable there'll be a lot of companies failing, but a lot of rich people still left from it.
David, what are your thoughts?
Well, I do think that the basic laws of capitalism is what goes up must come down at some point. So it's a question of not if but when that this bubble bursts, and to what extent that it bursts. Will it be as catastrophic as it was back in 1999 or with the housing bubble? We don't know yet.
Yeah, I think that it's different when it comes to the stock market, because last time it was a boom that went across everything. So it wasn't just the tech sector. Everything ballooned. Companies that had nothing to do with technology ballooned during that time.
But when you have a city that's so dependent on one sector, of course, then the impact on San Francisco and the region is going to be enormous.
Right.
David, final thoughts from you. You're just launching Vision SF. It's a new think tank to present alternative ideas in San Francisco.
Yeah, we have three main aims. One is to create a think tank to present alternative ideas. Number two is to raise money to put into local media so we have more investigative reporting on the powers, elite in the city, who's running this San Francisco, so it becomes more transparent, politics in the city. And finally, we want to develop a new generation of leadership, because we can't have a situation again where a mayor like Ed Lee runs unopposed. We need to have a new crop of talent that comes up in the city that has very civic-minded and wants to take us into the future.
And Jason, final thoughts from you. You spend so much time writing about these issues. What are your thoughts on how people can get involved?
Right. Well, I think that just getting people informed on how you can be pro-technology, that you can love technology, which, as you know, I do, and still object to the financial models that exist, and that you can separate that from those from each other.
Well, you know, when we do shows about these issues, we often invite on Apple or Facebook or in Google, but they never come on the show. You still work in this industry.
Yeah,
what are you
do.
Hearing from people who work in the industry?
They are really still riding on the bubble, and they're not really all that worried. However, a lot of the older workers that I know who are involved find themselves laid off in great frequency these days. So companies rise and fall and shrink. They do, as of this point, are able to get jobs relatively quickly someplace else, because when one falls, another picks up. But there's going to be a point where this just runs out of cash. And we're getting close to that point now. There's a lot of private equity, as I said, involved in this market. And they're going to start being very impatient that they're not getting a return pretty soon, especially if there's more financial stress in the world with loans from countries like Greece starting to go bad. So as economic times get more tight, a lot of that money from Russia, which has been in the tech
and
business.
And Puerto Rico, close along.
Right.
Yeah, we're putting together a show about financial investment and people overseas who are buying property in the Bay Area.
Right. And they're also investing in tech companies through venture companies.
And then quickly, Jason, what are you hearing from your colleagues about the social issues that David brings up?
Well, my colleagues who are the social colleagues or the technology colleagues, the technology colleagues don't talk about it all that much. The social colleagues, of course, do.
Rose, if I could throw out an email, if people are interested in Vision SF and we'd like everyone to join us across the political spectrum, they can email me at David@TalbotPlayers, like football players, TalbotPlayers.com.
Do you have a Facebook page?
Yes, I do. I'm ashamed to say.
David Talbot is former editor-in-chief of Salon.com, author of Season of the Witch, and one of the founders of Vision SF. Jason Ben-Levy is author of Too Much Magic, Pulling the Plug on the Cult of Tech. Thank you both for coming in.
Thanks, Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Is the Uber economy good or bad for workers? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about labor laws and how they affect the explosion of independent contractors. The California Labor Commission recently ruled that one of Uber's drivers qualifies as an employee rather than an independent contractor. So how should laws surrounding these services develop? What do we need to know about companies relying on independent contractors? And how should those workers be treated? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Knock Wynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.